Once more unto the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall up with our English dead. It's always such a good and bloody opening to our program. Welcome to the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure, and on the air with me, I have
Jeff McClure, who has no English dead to fill up walls with.
No, neither of us actually have any English dead to fill up any walls. Seems that that would be even more expensive than lumber got to recently, so I'm not sure why anyone would want to do it, but Henry V was very impressed with his own ability to do it, so Harfleur immediately succumbed to that grisly image.
Well, this, the idea of having your walls filled up with English dead and them stinking probably was enough to make any city surrender.
Yeah, I think you don't want your walls filled with English dead. Fine, we're done. Don't fight, please.
By the way, folks, in case you think we're crazy, we are. That's beside the point. We're quoting from Henry V, Shakespeare. A guy named Will Shakespeare wrote a few years ago.
Bill.
A relatively popular play that turned into a pretty good movie.
More than one pretty good movie. I think there's another one of it coming out very soon, if it hasn't come out already, which is supposed to be quite as good as the Branagh version. Anyway, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, in which we will talk to you about Shakespeare, occasionally. Sorry, I know. We will try to stay out of Elizabethan English. We'll instead use economicese, which is just as intelligible to most people.
Yes.
Right. So this is Jake McClure. Jeff McClure is with me. We have some disclosures to tell you about, because anytime you start talking about money, if you're not being disclosed, then either you're not being regulated or you have no clothes on to begin with.
Yes.
Right. So the Personal Wealth Coach is the name of the radio program, but it's also the name of a registered investment advisory firm that's registered with the SEC. Just because it's registered with the SEC doesn't mean that they somehow think that we are angels. There are regulators. They don't give approval for squat. So there is no implied approval by any government agency. How's that for a disclosure?
The secretary will deny all knowledge.
And will self-destruct this program if they think that we are hinting at any kind of approval. So there.
Yes.
You want to take the next disclosure?
Let's see. We don't pay for this radio program. Of course, we're not paid for the radio program either, which means we're really goofy. And we've been doing it a long time, like 2.5 decades or something like that.
20 being paid plus for. Years of enforced unemployment.
And we do advertise on KTEM, although I don't think there's any quid pro quo. There might be. I've never looked for it.
Yeah,
we advertise for the radio program, which is really goofy.
So does the studio. They also advertise for us, so it's kind of a joint venture.
We do gain some benefit in that apparently a lot of our clients listen to it. And we get an opportunity to communicate with our clients. I don't know if we've gotten a lot of clients from this radio show over the years, but we have a lot of fun doing it.
Yeah, just to kind of give a side loan, our clientele is generally pretty high net worth, and most people that have, you know, $10 million to drop somewhere generally don't make their decision based off of listening to a radio program. It might influence them to some extent, but so there is a little bit of that, but the vast, vast reason why we do this is because it brings up the entire community. The more you guys and we know about economics, what's going on in the world, the better decisions we make. And we do actually long-term get clients out of this, people that have listened for years and years. It's a different kind of investment, maybe. But that's not why we do it. Education.
We also have podcasts, by the way, which you can find either by just Googling TPWC podcast or going to your favorite podcast provider. And I bring that up because I just spoke to somebody who potentially might become a client, who said that she had a lot of information about us. And I said, where did you get it? She said, I listened to your podcast. So that's cool.
She's the one.
Yeah.
We actually
her. That's what I said to her. You're the one that's listening to the podcast.
Right. And we have at least two people listening to this radio program right now. Wait, no, I'm not listening. There's only one. We do have a studio audience of one at this moment. So at any given moment, it could be anywhere between one and or three and zero people listening at this moment. Well, maybe there are some others. We do actually have some questions out there, but we haven't hit all the disclosures.
Yes, we have to say that the information we are going to present on this educational program, because it's not investment advice we give on this program, even though that we are the principals of a registered investment advisory firm. What we give is information on this program that is intended to be educational, because investment advice is only given to individuals based on their specific circumstances.
Wait, you have to speak faster and more monotone when you say that. We have to work on this.
Well, let me go to the next one.
You've got to use the deem. You're going to hit all of the check marks on this one for sure.
I got to do this now.
Okay.
The information we present on this radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information.
Warranty or guarantee, accuracy or completeness. So how about that?
Cool.
All right, so what happened in the market this week?
It went down. It stayed pretty much where it was. It's 44 Wall Street is where the New York Stock Exchange was.
Sinking in real estate as the market dropped precipitously. There was a sinkhole forming in Wall Street. No.
Actually, the stock market did sort of an interesting thing. It actually hit records on Monday and Tuesday.
Record
and
up.
Wednesday morning,
record highs. Yeah.
Record up. And on Wednesday morning, it was crawling towards the 4,400 mark, and everybody was kind of, well, not everybody. All three of us had watched that, were kind of holding our breath saying, is it going to cross 4,400?
Because zeros are important. It's different than 4,399 somehow.
Then the labor department messed things up.
Yeah, shame on
them.
They
went into labor or something.
Yeah.
They came out and said that inflation year over year, 1 year inflation was 5.4% according to the consumer price index, which is silly. It was not unexpected, but it made headlines all over the place and people started selling, and they gradually sold off through Friday, so that in the end, the S&P 500 was down 0.98% for the week.
I have a good study to talk about for exactly what you talked about just now, but we'll get to that later.
But it printed a whopping 1% below its record close, still up over 15% year to date. The news on Friday, looking back over the week, said it was the weakening of consumer sentiment, which was announced on Friday by the University of Michigan.
So wait, and if that was, what you're saying is that the market dropped on Wednesday because on Friday we found out about a weakening of... Wait a minute.
You got it. The market is pressing it. Didn't you know that?
Of course it is. Wait, what?
Wait a minute. The market typically, not every time.
Headlines are silly.
Every time. The market drop often triggers a recession. I mean, we weren't in a recession or a depression in 1929 in October when the market went nosediving.
Right. It's true. So it is prescient. It is actually considered a leading indicator. But to drop on Wednesday for news that hadn't come out until Friday, that's like
really
a psychic indicator.
It is. It worked really, really well.
So what we're saying is that's not the reason why it dropped.
The reason it dropped is because it had a fear fit. A fear fit. I like that. That's my term.
All right. Nice.
It's got a dash between it. It's got a fear dash fit. It's a kind of fit. Actually, what happens?
A hyphenated fear fit. Right.
We hit a series of records. Matter of fact, we hit like 9 days in a row with record closes, and that makes people nervous who are interested in not seeing their money go away. The traders who say this is as high as it's going to get, I'm going to take some of my money off. Let me find some good excuse to take some of my money out of the market. And so they started looking for something to come along that would give them an excuse other than to say, I just want to take my money out of the market because I'm scared.
And so two days later, they go, well, that's the reason why I did it on Wednesday.
You got it. Yep. That's the way most humans make major decisions, by the way. We make the decision based on emotion, and then we come back and justify it with logic.
Yes, that is backed up by study after study after study. We justify our decisions based on information we didn't have at the time. It's just part of who we are as humans.
There's a general fear, and it's echoed through the financial media, and it's echoed certainly in the Wall Street Journal and other print publications, well, print and digital publications, that the Fed will cut off the recovery before it recovers. And they've traditionally done that, not every time, They didn't do it in 2008 and 2009. After the 2008 and 2009, after under Bernanke, they very carefully kept interest rates low for quite a while.
They certainly didn't do it in the 1970s at almost any point at all.
Yeah, but they've done it a few times in the past.
Yeah,
and so there's this because it's a feedback loop where traders are afraid of it. They talk to reporters who then report it, which causes more traders to be afraid of it. There's this fear that the Federal Reserve will step up and raise interest rates and cut off their bond buying and strangle the economy before it recovers.
Oh, dear.
And is that the Fed traditionally, and not every time, but has from time to time, raised interest rates too soon, as they did in 1937, I think it was, that relaunched the Great Depression. And from time to time, the Fed has cut off the recovery from a recession too soon. And there's a great deal of fear they're going to do it again, because when the headline inflation hits 5.4%, which it did year over year, that's scary to people who don't actually look at the numbers. They say, oh, 5.4%, that's outrageous inflation. The Fed is going to have to raise interest rates. In fact, Jerome Powell and the guys in the Federal Reserve are not dummies.
Well,
contrary to popular belief.
Popular belief is that they're dummies, except that if you sat down and had a conversation with them, you would find that you probably don't understand. Well, maybe you understand each individual word, but putting them in a string, a sentence, it's hard. It takes scholarly approach to understand what they speak about.
I was reading the transcript of Jerome Powell's testimony first to the House of Representatives Committee and then to the Banking Committee. And then
well, you
to the
know
Senate
you're
Banking
weird
Committee.
if you're doing that. You are reading a transcript of the Federal Reserve Chairman talking to Congress.
Well, actually, I was reading that. I was far more interested in the questions that the congresspersons were asking the chairman of the Federal Reserve. And yeah, somebody was dumb in that conversation, but it wasn't Jerome Powell.
No. No,
actually, they weren't dumb. Dumb means unable to speak. They were less than.
You might call them an elected official, which should sum up all of the IQ required. Sorry, elected officials, if you're reading, but not sorry too.
That's not true. There's some smart elected officials.
This is why we don't run for office. This is the IQ drainage happens as soon as you get in there.
It's not true.
I don't know. I think somebody could write a dissertation on it. There might be. They might actually get government funding to do it with, which should tell you that solves the whole thing there, right there. It is like
anyway,
a self-fulfilling prophecy.
I don't know how much you didn't get, but the market actually dropped, the S&P 500 dropped 0.98% for the week. It's still up 15% year to date, which is really good, and it's about 1% off of its record close, and that made headlines that the Dow dropped and was afraid or something, and the S&P 500 dropped. But 1%, particularly in the summertime, is pretty mild. That's the understatement of the millennium. Let's see, what else happened interestingly in the market?
Here's a good question.
The CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index, we follow that one too. It's up 16.3% for the year. It was actually down 2.6% for the week.
It went down faster because we're seeing the big tech revival, and the value stocks are kind of swinging back in the down section. Still doing better year over year.
I want to talk about weird stocks a little bit at some point, too. I was looking at Starbucks, for example.
You know, the stock or like a coffee?
The stock.
Ah, well, there's less statistics involved there in the coffee.
SPUX, which is one of those stocks that's soaring. It's a big company. It's
driving the
S&P 500 up. It's trading at 140 times next year's earnings.
Wow.
In other words, if they...
That's going to require 140... I mean, if we go back to like a decent price-to-earnings ratio of like 15, you're still going to require those that drink Starbucks to have about 10 times as much Starbucks as they had this year.
The issue is, how many Starbucks can they open and still be this profitable? And the question is, I think they got about as many open as they're going to be able to open.
I'm going to have to break in here with the a break in from another version of me. What do you mean, how many Starbucks can I drink at a time? I can drink as many Starbucks as I want. I can do this. It's fine. Okay, there's no problem at all. My impersonation of what Starbucks requires to be worth what it is worth today.
So there's certain sections of the market that are clearly very overpriced. The FANGs are overpriced, which I never can remember. It's Facebook, Apple, Alphabet,
you see,
Google.
The FANG terminology was used at a time when Google was part of it. It's now Alphabet, so there's no G and there's an extra A. It's really, really messing up that cool acronym that people were using.
So it's kind of
FAON. It's a FAON.
But Microsoft ought to be in there someplace, so there ought to be an M in it.
FAONimum.
Anyway, there's about five big companies that currently have 22% of the value of the S&P 500, which, by the way, is a record.
Oh, wait a minute. Mana? Microsoft, Alphabet, Netflix, Apple. Wait, we got to put Facebook in. Manoff. There we go.
Manoff.
Yeah.
Anyway.
There we go. We just have to get them to keep changing their names until we get a cool acronym. Sorry. They are taking off.
Well, then there's an oddity that only an economics geek could really appreciate going on in the market. And I find it quite fascinating. And I've read articles and articles and articles about it. Really smart people saying in lots and lots of words, we don't know.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Theoretically, the reason the market dropped 1% this last week was because of fear of high inflation, fear of what the Federal Reserve would do with high inflation. What the Federal Reserve does, if they want to choke off high inflation, is raise interest rates. That would mean rationally that bonds should be rising in interest rates because interest rates are going to be higher in the future. And if you're going to buy, for instance, a 10-year Treasury bond, you want to be compensated for all that inflation that supposedly is going to come.
Except
that the yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury note fell 5% for the week to 1.294%. It was up as high as 1.75 back in May. It's been falling ever since.
And in a vacuum that only represented the United States economy, that would make zero sense. And that's why we're hearing all these people write with lots and lots of words that they don't know what's going on here. Except we're not in a vacuum. Maybe a Dyson.
I think it could be. A Dyson vacuum?
Yeah. It's British. So you've got to have something outside the U.S. to hold a vacuum that includes the U.S. So I would have to say it's a Dyson.
Well, I thought you were talking about a Dyson sphere. Well, actually, I think it would be Hoover if he's going to be British.
True. We could do that.
You talk about hoovering up things.
Yes.
Anyway, the market is the yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury note has dropped from about 1.75% at the beginning of May to 1.3% today, which is a little odd. If there's that much fear of inflation. Now, there's probably some pretty good reasons for that, but basically interest rates, at least temporarily, are going to stay down. One of the biggest reasons, and this is really goofy, that the interest rate has been dropping on the 10-year Treasury is because as of the government is scheduled to run out of money around October 12th.
Right. So we're back into those extraordinary procedures that the Treasury is doing. They're not issuing new debt at the moment.
What they've got to do, by the way, is get the holdings under the, when the law goes back into effect for the debt ceiling, which does, I think, on August 1st, they have to get their holdings at the Federal Reserve down to $450 billion. Since they started at $1.8 trillion being held at the Federal Reserve, they're trying to spend that rather than issue new 10-year Treasury notes. And so there's a shortage. It's classic supply and demand, I think, is what's creating this combined. Yeah, it's really classic supply and demand. First off, the United States has the only sovereign. Well, first, we have the most secure sovereign security in the world, according to the markets of the world. And other people want to hold it because it pays some interest, which the others don't. For instance, the German 10-year Bund is still in negative territory. And the 10-year U.S. is paying, even at 1.3%, is still paying something. So you get 1.3% a year for holding it, which is better than nothing.
And if a lot of people are trying to,
you're quite confident you will get your investment back.
Yeah, if we've got people all over the world wishing to loan money, that causes interest rates to drop, and so that's how interest rates drop. So all these people saying, "How is this happening?" You just watch where the money's coming from.
So the Fed is, instead of issuing 10-year notes, are taking money from their account at the Federal Reserve to get it down by August 1st to $450 billion, which is going to be quite a stretch for them to do.
Yeah, they're going to have to spend a lot of money. Well, Congress doesn't have a lot of trouble with that.
They've already spent the money, actually. The extended child care credit.
Yeah, the checks start going out. They started going out 2 days ago on the 15th. July 15th.
Drawing the money down.
Right. They are sending out checks to every family that has kids in their last tax return said they weren't above a certain amount of money and income. So you should expect to start either seeing it appear in your bank account or as a debit card. You might actually get a check. That's kind of unusual these days. That's interesting. So if you have kids and you start receiving this, this is something that we should warn people about anyway. If your income is higher this year and you believe that you would not be getting this credit if you filed your taxes, expect to have a tax bill for the money that you're receiving. Like, just know that that's coming. It's not free money. This is not like a stimulus check. You might have to pay this back if your income is too high. So keep that in mind. And I know a lot of people out there that are sitting, well, if their income's too high, why should they care if they have to pay it back? Because people with high income doesn't mean they have high savings. If they're spending all their money every month, it's going to be a nasty surprise in April of next year that they owe like $4,000 or $5,000 back to the IRS that they didn't expect to owe. So just keep it in mind. Check it. See if you're getting money for it and say, am I going to have to pay this back? There. I have said my speech.
By the way, Chris emailed us and said, just call them fan stocks.
Fan? But then we would, we're not pronouncing all the A's. It's much more fun to make fun of acronyms.
There's got to be an M in there someplace, too.
Yeah, and then Microsoft's not even in there.
Oh, call them phantom stocks.
I see what you did there. It doesn't really matter that there's no F in phantom. Because we're changing all the letters anyway. I see what you're doing there. I like this. This is like a congressional acronym. It doesn't have to mean anything. I get it.
The Secure Act had nothing to do with making things secure. It made a lot of people insecure.
Right, exactly. And if you actually look at the words that made up the word secure, none of them had to do with what the bill was. So, yes.
Anyway.
So it's a congressional. It's the phantom stocks. That's what we're going to call them from now on, with a PH.
So interest rates have been falling, and they've been falling since May, which means that bond rates, the bond values have been going up, relatively speaking, from negative positions. But that's kind of weird, because if you actually look at the typical trading value of bonds that are out 5 or 10 years right now, in many cases they're trading at a premium, and I don't think a lot of people understand that. A lot of money is flowing into bond funds. Matter of fact, more money is flowing into bond funds right now than flowing into stock funds, because people are scared of the high market. But the problem is, if you buy into a bond fund, it's very important to look at the average price of the bond in that fund. And if it's 103, for example, you have a guaranteed 3% loss to maturity. Then you got to look at the average maturity, and if the maturity is just a few years, you've got a 3% loss in a few years guaranteed built into the fund. People just look at the yield. By the way, there's some weird yields out there. Did you know that?
I have seen a lot of weird yields. What is the weird thing that you're looking at?
There are funds that are proclaiming 8% yields.
Yep, I have seen that. I wouldn't trust it, but
they're TIPS funds, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities funds, and they're claiming an 8% yield.
But when you look at the actual TIPS yield, it's not 8%.
And they really aren't yielding 8%. There's just a weird SEC. It's called the SEC rate, which is composed of rates put together under a complex set of rules issued by the SEC that don't apply very well. It looks tremendous, but you should be very, very, very much afraid of those. Anything, by the way, where you get an interest rate higher than you would get in the bank or in a treasury, similar treasury security, means that something bad is happening.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, well, what I was going to say is that especially if the thing that you're buying is supposed to be made of the stuff that's not paying as much.
Right now, for example, there are still 6% treasury bonds floating around out there. 6%. They have a 6% coupon on them. But if you look at the yield to maturity on those same bonds, it's like 1.something%, 1.05 or 1.3 or 1.2%. in the yield to maturity, which means that the price of the bond is well above its maturity value, and it's going to mature at some point. And
that means
historically have had a lot of fun saying, I can get you a U.S. Treasury bond that has a coupon rate, it'll pay you 6%.
Problem with that is you have to pay extra to get it, which means your yield to maturity is actually negative. But wait, there's one more factor that could lead into this. You'll still have to pay income taxes on the interest that you receive, even though it's principal. There.
I like that.
Yeah. So
I say don't like.
No, don't like it at all. Neither of us like it very much, but it's good to know. And when you hear an interest rate that's too good to be true, it's because guess what? Yeah, you know what I'm going to say, aren't you? You already know it. It's too good to be true. Yeah.
That's right. The other market that we follow pretty carefully is West Texas Intermediate crude oil, and it dropped 5% to 71.45 by the end of the week. It continues to trade over the weekend, so there wasn't a close. But anyway, OPEC reached at least a tentative agreement with UAE, the United Arab Emirates, to pump more oil.
Well, UAE is part of OPEC, but they've been having a tiff, a familial OPEC spat.
A tiff at OPEC.
Yes. A little spat.
Anyway,
but not
the other thing that's
special acquisition company, a spat.
That's happening across the board is the dollar is getting stronger, which causes the price of oil to go down, which sounds really weird. But see, we buy oil using dollars.
And so does everybody else.
The stronger the dollar is versus other currencies, the lower the price of oil gets. It's weird, but our exports are not. It hurts our exports. By the way, the producer price index came in, not the producer price, but the export, import, export. Nut prices came in. I thought they were sort of interesting.
The account deficit, the
no, not that.
Not that. I'm trying to figure out what export is.
The import export prices came in.
Ah, gotcha.
And the import prices are rising, and that makes headlines because it kind of builds inflation into the system and raises the producer price index. But our export prices are rising faster than the import prices. In other words, people around the world want our goods and services more than we want theirs, even though we're buying more. So the price on the U.S. goods and services around the world is going up, which is a good thing. It says something about the quality of what we make here in the United States.
And that's actually a fantastic segue into our first question that we got before we started the program. So this question's actually an hour old. That's how long this person's been waiting. John, thank you. His question.
You think he's still waiting?
I would. He told us when we went off the air. So it's
cool.
Possible that he's still listening. We haven't lost all of our people. It's amazing.
We haven't lost both listeners.
Right. What? I'm sorry. I wasn't listening. What?
Yeah.
So John, his first question is secular stagnation. How about that's a really fantastic way to start any conversation, by the way. Just walk up and say, so how do you feel about secular stagnation? And his question is, does it exist and is it short or long term impact? And he's got, as is one of my favorite moments of every week, he gets a paper copy of the Wall Street Journal in which he takes a digital picture of it and emails it to us so that we're looking at a digital copy of an analog copy and we can back it up with our digital version of the same newspaper. So, yes, it's very deep, very meta. He's circled an area. It says former U.S. Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers argued, by the way, he goes by Larry Summers. He argued in 2014 that aging populations, high savings, and weak private investment are persistent trends in our era that make it hard for economies to operate at their potential. And they dubbed that secular stagnation. And it's a real thing. And if you think about where we are right now, we have an aging population. It's true. We have high savings. People talk about how much cash is out there. We don't have weak private investment right now. We have the opposite. We have an explosion in private investment like we have not seen since World War II. And that's with inflation and population adjustments. If you don't adjust for population, there's just absolutely nothing like this we've seen before. Larry Summers was looking at Japan when he said this. High savings, they're not interested in taking a lot of risk. This can lead to a stagnation in innovation and a lot of things that can cause the entire economy to slowly shrink. And that's happened in Japan. Now, their per capita economy has grown during the same period. So while the whole country has shrunk in monetary power, each individual in the country has gotten stronger. How's that for weird? Shrinking populations are weird. So is it a thing, and is it going to affect us right now? Well, no, it's not appropriate for who we are right now. We could see this in our future if we continue to have an aging population and more of us turn farther away from the riskiness of new innovation. But it's not what we're seeing right now. And that was a really, really long-winded answer to say, don't worry about it. There you go.
Yeah, there is something to worry about, and that is if we continue to have anti-immigration feelings in the United States, we can get in some trouble.
Yeah.
Japan is totally anti-immigration. I mean, it's very, 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 very difficult to immigrate to Japan, like approaching impossibility, like it is in many other countries around the world. And as a result, their population is indeed stagnant. It's actually shrinking at this point.
Right, rapidly.
And they also have a very conservative culture, so they save a lot of money and they invest relatively small amounts of money. The government has stepped in historically to do public works projects and utilities and infrastructure to make up the difference. And it's worked reasonably well in Japan, but there's an end to that. Of course, they also have a very, very high income tax rate.
Yeah.
In the United States, we tend to...
Well, they have to have a high income tax so that they can pay the interest on the debt that they owe to the same people that they're charging the income taxes from.
You got it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You got basically it. People are paying their taxes so they can borrow it back, so they can loan it. It's really weird.
Yeah. It's Japan.
The government is borrowing from the people who are paying the taxes. It's Japan.
And they have to pay interest to the people who are paying the taxes, but their interest rate's extremely low. So it's actually a good deal for the government and the people as long as they don't want a great deal of growth. How's that for confusing?
Right. And is there a danger to the United States? Yes, there is. If we continue to have restrictive immigration policies, and we have some very restrictive policies right now, then our population will shrink. And our population will grow older. And more people will be on Social Security and retired and not working.
And less people will be working.
And that could be bad. That would be bad over a period of time. It's important to remember, and I realize this may rub political feathers the wrong direction.
As economists, that's what we do. We just, in the same sentence, we can ruffle the feathers of both major political parties, and they look at us like, you must be part of the other side, and both sides are saying it to us, so.
That's true. We are always part of the other side.
Yeah.
The issue is that the United States is a nation of immigrants, primarily. There's only about, I was thinking somebody said 8 million Native Americans left in the United States, pure blood Native Americans. It may be a low number, but here's the point. We are a nation of immigrants, and our innovations have coincided with waves of immigration in the United States. If we cut off immigration and say we're just going to leave everything as it is, it'll stagnate, and people will get older, and they'll get more comfortable, and then we'll go broke.
Yeah, if people doubt that innovation is connected to immigration, let me just start naming some names here. Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, Watt, Bell, Tesla, Einstein. I could go on. These are immigrants. These are the immigrant wave that's funding and running our technological innovation right now and have been since the beginning. It's who we are, is that we bring in fresh blood constantly.
Don't forget Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Well, I haven't seen a lot of technological innovations. Well, we got to play some commercials anyway. It is time to play commercials. Yeah. We still have lots of questions to answer from people that have emailed in. But if you would like to ask a question for us to answer on the air, our email addresses are available at Jeff or Jake, either one of us, at tpwc.com. That's Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie, or as we prefer to say, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. So if you have any questions, give us an email. And we'll get to it on the other side of these commercials. We'll be right back. And we're back. Welcome back to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jake and
Jeff
McClure. We are the Bald Duo. We're here to talk to you about economics and the, yes, finance, anything to do with money. And there's, so far, we've been covering the really, really big picture about what's going on in the world and how does it affect us and what's the market been doing and some questions from listeners as well. And we have another question from John, and he's talking about the Wall Street Journal, and he reads it. And he says, every issue has the previous day's market results. A lot of info, charts, graphs, statistics. Are there 5 to 6 items to look at to get a macro overview of the overall market? The easy answer to that is you really don't need to look at it in depth every day. We don't. I don't look at in depth at the market on a day-to-day basis. It's too much information and it's not relevant.
TMI.
TLDR, which is my favorite. Too long, didn't read. Just put that on the end of lots of stuff. So when we look at it, we do touch on some metrics. Some of the stuff that we look at more on a monthly is what's the overall price to earnings ratio for the entire market forward looking. And that's a big metric. What would be a metric that is one of your favorite metrics looking forward or back?
I do look at the price to earnings ratio pretty carefully, and I also look at the moving averages. Let's look at a couple of moving averages. Bottom line to it is, yes, and I like to look at the growth and value indices and see what's going on.
Right.
Right now, the large cap growth is leading the market upward. It's driving the train. And I don't know if it's in those charts that you're looking at, but I like to see, have to hunt around for it sometimes, to see what percentage of the S&P 500 is composed of a small number of stocks, and then look at what those small number of stocks are trading in.
Right.
And that's, we're in a bull market. We're in a classic bull market in a growth period, which means that we are led by large cap growth organizations, large cap growth companies. I have to say that, not put an R in.
So one really, really cool thing that I used to look at is just kind of do a quick catalog of positive or negative headlines about the economy and the market.
That's good.
And that's not a statistic that they'll do for you. That's one you'll have to come up with on your own. But that's something that we look at very much, is if all of the headlines are consistently glowingly optimistic, we start getting nervous. If you have a really good mix of pessimism and optimism, that's pretty good. If it's all pessimism, that is fantastic. And it's because if the majority of people are based on majority of headlines, the same concept, this opinion, time out for just a second. The media tends to feed to you what you are prepared to eat. Which means that if you're optimistic, they will feed you optimism. Unless there's something horrible that happens, and then they can sell a lot of papers by taking your optimism and twisting it to pessimism. But by far, the best sellers are pessimism. Once that goes away, and it's all optimism, that means the last buyers are bought. They've already put their money where their mouth is. If everybody says at the cocktail party the market's going up, then they've already invested, which means now we're at maybe the top of the top. We're not seeing that right now, but that's one of the things that we look for. How many optimistic versus pessimistic headlines are there? There's a lot of pessimistic headlines right now, which is fantastic. So that wasn't what he was asking for, but that was what we gave him anyway.
Those charts are like reading tea leaves.
Without getting to drink the tea. That's thing that I don't like.
That's terrible. I don't know if you ever tried to read tea leaves. I've tried to read tea leaves and I couldn't make anything out of it. So obviously I'm not psychic. But the important thing is to recognize that most of those are just data. They're just noise. And if you're an economist, you can probably, because there's so much data in the Wall Street Journal and other sources like that, you can take your prejudice about what you think the market's going to do and build a case for it.
Yeah.
If you're trading in a specialized area, which quite a few people do, very tiny little specialized areas, some of those charts are very important. I just basically look at the market as a whole and look at the economy as a whole.
No.
The bigger the numbers, the the better it works. In other words, the bigger the picture we're looking at, the better it works in the long term.
Right. Now, this leads... Go ahead.
It's important to remember something. With all that data, nobody forecast the market collapse last year, the drop in the market last year.
Right.
Nobody forecast the market drop in 1987. And they didn't have as much data, but they had a lot of data at the time. And the data is just something that the Wall Street Journal feeds its readers because somebody wants to read it. Somebody wants to see it.
And this is the perfect segue. I have to use this now because I've been pregnant with this all episode.
You've been pregnant?
Yes, with this data. I must give birth. The Labor Department will be pleased. Wharton just came out with a paper. Wharton is
the newspaper.
They come up with papers quite a bit. An academic paper. It was done by the accounting professor Jeremy Michaels, and its title is Retail Investor Trade and Pricing of Earnings, which doesn't tell you what it's about. Basically, what he says in here is that these new retail investors, what does that mean? What's a retail investor? For many years, probably a decade, the vast majority of the market moves that have taken place in any given period have been from large traders, institutional traders, ones that are managing mutual funds, ones that are managing pension funds. Those big moves moved to the market. Well, the pandemic hit and a lot of retail investors went in individually and started buying and selling stock. And that's changed the way the market moves. It's fascinating. It's not the first time it's happened, but it's worth looking at. And so in his studies, Dr. Michaels looks at it and he says, what's going on here? And what he found out is that the market tends to move based on any news, positive or negative, in this new or refreshed era of retail investors being a big mover. Even, and it says, any earnings surprise tends to lead to a jump upward in the price of that company. And he dug deeper in the behavioral aspect of it and said, basically what people are doing is they see the name of a company. It doesn't matter if it's a positive or a negative, and then they look up that company in their trading app. So the news hits, they look at it. It's that old thing about any news is good news, even if it's negative. For the market right now in the retail side, just having your name, your company name associated with some kind of surprise, positive or negative, has tended to cause the price of the company to go up because the new retail investors are buying based on the research that they're doing at this moment, not based on a great deal of previous knowledge about the company. So the fact that the company's name appears makes them do research on the company. If they like the company, they buy it. In a lot of cases, people buy it because it's been going up since the news came out about the negative earnings or the positive. It's fascinating. We had an era, and we talked about this during that era, of surprisingly low volatility following the Great Recession. A lot of the retail investors got scared out of the market. It was just the big institutional guys. The averages were beating the active managers consistently. As soon as you get into this kind of volatility again, where people are buying basically because they see the name of the company, the professionals come in and start making better profits than usual. This is throughout history. Whether that happens again is worth watching. I think it's fascinating. So, I mean, it's strange to think he's looking at what metrics do we look at. There's so much to take in. And I think most people that are reading the news, especially finance news, for the first times in their life, they've been doing this for maybe 12 months and they're still trying to get used to it. There's so much coming in. They see the name, they buy it.
Like you said, a lot of it has to do with the fact that there's no commissions being charged to buy and sell stocks.
Right. Or no
and
obvious
a lot of
ones.
People, there's a very fundamental difference between speculative purchases of worthless companies or nearly worthless companies and investing. It's a worthless company. This has been a consistent ever since tulip bulbs in 1620 or 1640. I can't remember which.
There's the tulip bulb bubble. There's a great book on it called Tulipomania.
And there's or the South Seas Company, which never had any actual earnings, but drove the English stock market first all the way up and then into a crash.
Or the dot-com bubble.
The point is people buy something and it price goes up, so they buy some more of it because the price goes up. And then other people start buying it and the price goes up. And then finally somebody starts to sell and the price goes down. That doesn't work in the long term. A few people are going to, that's what's called a zero. Well, actually, it's a sub-zero trade. The issue is that people who are buying it may make money when it goes up if they sell in the right time. But it's the guy with the quickest twitch on the finger. It's a gambling issue.
Yeah, and most
just
people
a trading of money back and forth between different people, and there's no actual money being made by the company.
Most of the retail buyers right now, and this is from lots of different sources, including Robinhood. Most of the retail investors that are making these trades, that is feeding this other data, don't know when they would sell. And how do we know that? They haven't set limit orders. They haven't set a sell order. So they purchased a thing, and the professionals are ready to sell. And then what you were saying, they've got that twitch finger, they're ready, only it's not even a twitch finger. It's a preset sell order. Hit this, sell. Most of the retail investors don't have that. They bought it. They don't really know why they bought it, except that they saw the name. Wow. Don't know what that was about. It's almost time for our news break. Maybe there were more commercials to play. Anyway, do you have a wrap up for this hour?
Well, I want to say that the market dropped about 1% based on fears of not actually fears of inflation, but fears that the Federal Reserve would move too soon, despite the fact that Chairman Powell very clearly said for several hours twice during the week that we're not moving too soon. We're not moving anytime soon. The market is at within 1% of its all-time high. We've got about a 15% gain in the S&P 500 this year. The economy is doing very, very well. We'll talk about that more next hour. It's rocking and rolling along. Jamie Dimon says the consumer is ready to buy and is spending money like mad, and he has a better pulse, better finger on the pulse than does the University of Michigan, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. All right, so we're about out of time for this hour. If you would like to talk to us off the air, we actually do management of portfolios and fiduciary advice on a one-on-one basis for people of high net worth, trusts, foundations. If you just have some questions, give us a call off the air, because we give fiduciary advice off the air. And the local number for that is
254-947-1111. That's 254-947-1111.
Or toll free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. Or you can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. We've got recordings of the radio program up there going back, podcasts. You can go to your podcast provider, whichever one, look us up there, TPWC or The Personal Wealth Coach. You can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.